It's great to be here for several reasons. First of all, because I think anytime we can honor journalism, especially alternative journalism, especially these days, it's a very important thing to do. I've been participating in a lot of 50th anniversary Fifth Estate events in Detroit, which is my mother planet. I don't dream about Ann Arbor, but I dream about Detroit still, where I lived all my life until I moved here 13 years ago.
And you're welcome to come back, Harvey.
I visit. So it's good to be here in Ann Arbor and having an event like this at this amazing library, and I'm happy to be a part of it. So thank you for the invite. I'm looking forward to tonight's discussion because, among other things, I've only been here 13 years. I'm a newbie. I know very little about the alternative press in Ann Arbor. I didn't go to Huron. I didn't graduate from Pioneer. I went to Mumford High School in Detroit. And those were what my dreams are about.
Hello, Mumford.
Mumford.
Yeah.
65. Thank you. But I do know a thing or two about publishing alternative newspapers, which I think had something to do with why the library asked me to participate. The format is going to be very simple. It's going to be very informal because this is an alternative panel. Can't formalize it too much. So I'll be introducing each of the panelists. They'll have about 3 or 5 minutes or so to talk about themselves and explain what their paper was it about and how it was different than other alternative papers at the time. And then I'll ask questions, but it's going to be very informal. We're going to engage each other and ask each other questions, and you guys are welcome to do it as well. We'll have a formal question and answer period before too long. We're looking forward to having the conversation with you as well as with each other. I want to introduce everybody first, and then we'll get you going. Ted and his wife Lori. Lori's here. Okay. Started Agenda back in 1986. Mm-hmm. 86, and it ran to 1998, which is a really good run for an alternative paper. It was an independent, non-aligned newspaper. I wish I had these words when I started the paper. There was no alternative press. There was no underground press. I didn't know what to call it, so we called it Detroit's New Progressive Biweekly, but I'm so pleased that we have labels now. Anyway, the Agenda did a wonderful job of servicing not only Ann Arbor, but nearby communities, and served as a forum for the area's liberal, leftist, progressive community and nonprofit organizations. And this is Ted, and he'll talk shortly. Dave over here is another Ann Arborite, along with Mary Morgan, started the Ann Arbor Chronicle.
Yes.
Yes. 2008 to 2014, which was really interesting because it wasn't a print paper. It was online completely, wasn't it?
Indeed.
Okay. Which covered the areas, civic and community organizations and government coverage, and did a lot of coverage of events and situations that the straight, listen to me, I'm showing my age, the straight press, excuse me, the mainstream press didn't cover at the time. Dave grew up in southern Indiana, the middle finger, as he calls it, of the South. I like that, of the South, and went off to school to study mathematics in Germany. No, not in Germany, and German.
And German.
And German. And of course, there he met Mary Morgan, who a woman he fell in love with, followed her wherever she went, and eventually landed him in Ann Arbor, where they started the paper. There aren't too many romantic stories about the creation of the underground press, but I'm sensing there is here. I didn't have a girlfriend when I was 17. It's one of the reasons I started the paper, don't tell anybody. No, that's not true. Barbara Bearfield is someone I do know from my era. In the underground press, worked in the on the Ann Arbor Sun from in the 1970s, when it was the White Panther. I wouldn't call it a mouthpiece, it was the house organ of the White Panther Party, which later became the Rainbow People's Party. Why am I telling you this? You all know this. And it then later became just an independent, really left-wing publication that covered music and art, not just politics, but music and art and culture. The Underground, the Alternative Press, often is labeled as being political in nature, and mostly it was, but our coverage of culture and arts and media was pretty cool at the time as well. Barbara started out as an artist for The Sun, a photographer, cartoonist, worked her way into advertising, design, a writer, and eventually served on the editorial board. And were you a publisher at one time?
Yes.
Wow. And art director of the newspaper. And that's Barbara Bearfield. A transplant of New York, Detroit, Ann Arbor-ish. And I want to hear about that story later. But I suppose we can start with that. I mean, what's a nice Detroit girl doing in Ann Arbor?
Well, I started in New York. I was born in New York, had my childhood there. And a child of the 60s. Let me see if I'm close enough to the microphone. It's not taped. Okay. So I wanted to go to college in a political, vibrant community, and Ann Arbor was certainly that in 1968. I wanted to go out to California. My mom said, not that far. So I got as far as Ann Arbor, which had a good art school. I went to the College of Architecture and Design here at U of M. And I think the turning point for me in Ann Arbor, besides just the political climate and things that were going on here, was going to the John Sinclair Freedom Rally, December 10th, 1971, along with 50,000 other people, a 10-hour event that really turned my world around. Not only were there just amazing musicians and speakers, everyone from Stevie Wonder and John Lennon and Yoko Ono and Bobby Seale, but the reason for this event was about a man being in jail for 10 years for smoking two joints, something that everybody probably in that audience, except maybe the police, undercover police, everybody had been doing. So it was about freedom. It was about trying to change the next generation. And I was very impressed with the organization and the political message, and felt, when I graduate college, I'm going to go and check these people out and see if I can help, because it seemed like something that would be a very worthwhile use of my efforts and time.
Thank you. Ted, what motivated you and Lori, I assume you were together at the time,
yes,
to start an alternative newspaper?
Well, actually, we came at it as a team. Having gone through a number of experiences, we met at the beginning of the 80s, and we're in a band together, a rock and roll band called Map of the World, and we were cab drivers. And when we were driving cab, I was part of a publication called Cab Art. And it was a news. It was a publication by, for, and about cab drivers. And it was a.
I didn't hear this coming.
It was a sensibility that really ended up informing Agenda, in that we published due to, first of all, there was something of a revolution going on in the tech world, and it was as simple as photocopying. And the availability now of Xerox, what everybody referred to as Xeroxing then, and photocopying. So as creative writers and what have you, misfits, us cab drivers got together and decided we would publish this cab art. And it initially it was called Cab Art Chronicles, which I find rings a bell with the new stuff. And what we did was we asked people to submit their whatever it was on a piece of 8.5 by 11. And we took all of them, put them in a stack, and then photocopied them and figured out how much they cost to print. And that's how much we sold them for. And we sold them out of our cabs and what have you. So it was a real unedited publication, to say the least. And we did that for a couple of years, and Actually, Lori had her own publication called No Words, which was visual arts. And again, it was a photocopy-based publication, and a lot of the community was involved in that. So we also were informed greatly by our experience with Latin American Solidarity Committee, which we, after we left the band, we had a lot of time on our hands, so we started going to this group's meetings, and they were just phenomenal, we thought. They were talking about the war in Central America and you know, trying to organize people in opposition to it. And we became involved with their publication called La Palabra, and we did some graphic arts and some editing and some publicity work for Latin American Solidarity Committee. We found out through working with the committee and all the attempts to get our events and our information in newspapers that we basically had to get arrested to get an article in the Ann Arbor News. So after you know, a couple of years of this, and then we got married in 1985 and traveled the country thinking about where we could start a publication like the one we had in mind, and we ended up coming back to Ann Arbor and doing it here because we had all our connections here.
And the rest is history.
Yes.
Great. Good. Dave, what's your story? What brought you to the Chronicle?
I'm glad you asked. So what's striking to me is that sort of the origin story that I have to tell is not nearly as high-minded as the stories we've just heard, but I'll tell it anyway. About 10 years ago, in fact, exactly 10 years ago, in 2005, this was sort of the golden era of blogging. I don't know if any of you remember it that way, but I do. All the cool internet kids had these things called web logs, and there was an intense debate at the time as to whether we should call them blogs or web logs, and you know whether it should be hyphenated or not. So I thought, I got to get me one of those. What shall I do? What will my blog be about? And so what I settled on was this notion that I would invite people over to my house and take them to my backyard and have them sit on a teeter-totter that I had built as a wedding anniversary present. So this is not a toy teeter-totter. This is an adult-sized teeter-totter, sort of built to adult specifications. And I would interview them while riding the teeter-totter, and I would document the whole thing with a transcript and a photograph taken from my vantage point on my end of the teeter-totter down the board to them sitting on the teeter-totter.
That
was the concept. And it was about this time of year in 2005, and I figured, yeah, I'll send out some invitations to some folks that I would like to recruit. And I figured, well, this is never going to happen. Really, the idea would be, I had this concept, I invited a bunch of people, nobody would come, so kind of like as a prank. Well, Renee Greff, who owns the Arbor Brewing Company with her husband, Matt, she said, sure, I'll do that. And it was actually the morning after an 8-inch snowfall. She came over to the house, and that was the first Teeter Talk interview. So a couple of years later, after I'd been doing these interviews, about one a week, Mary Morgan, my lovely bride, for whom I built the Teeter Totter wedding anniversary present, she was working at the Ann Arbor News. She decided that she'd accomplished everything that she wanted to accomplish there, and she wanted to launch her own news and information website. And I said, great, I can help, because I know how the internet works. So I threw myself into that, basically as an extension of the Teeter Talk interview series. And certainly, I would argue that a lot of the sensibilities that we adopted at the Chronicle came from my experience with Teeter Talk, the idea of meticulously documenting an actual physical event. So you actually had to ride the teeter-totter to gain access to the interview series. I did have a phone call with somebody I was trying to recruit, and he said, well, can't we just do it on the phone? And as I explained, well, no, you can't ride it teeter-totter on the telephone. You have to show up. And eventually I built a mobile teeter-totter that I would drag around on my bicycle trailer so I could go to people's houses or whatever venue.
Which journalism school taught you how to do this?
See, I didn't go to journalism school, see? So the idea of showing up, that's the job, that's the obligation, to show up to a place and to document what you see there and what you hear there. You go home, you do some research to figure out actually what it was that you saw and what you heard. That is the job. Mm-hmm. That came, I think, from my experience running Teeter Talk. And actually, we had a columnist for the Ann Arbor Chronicle, who's, I think, one of the best writers in the country, not just here locally, but if you ever have an opportunity to read something written by David Eric Nelson, just read it. At the end, you'll say, wow, that was a great piece of writing, even if you don't agree with what he had to say. I'm going to read you a quote from a column he wrote for the Chronicle. I'll tell you what it was about at the end, but we asked him to go to a place, and it was a place where he was the only reporter there. There was nobody from the mainstream press at this event. And part of his write-up about that experience was about this fact, that he was the only person there from the media. So here's the quote. But in the end, this isn't about Miss America. This is about us, the folks on my side of the screen, the media, and our failure to uphold the basic social contract we have with you. Our job isn't to republish corporate and government press releases, nor is it to bang out our own uninformed fact-free opinions about the world, nor is it to maximize per-click ad revenue. The job is about showing up at a place with our own goddamn eyes open, shaking hands, seeing what we see, listening to what we hear, going home to do some research to figure out what we saw and heard, and reporting the findings back to you folks on the far side of the screen. If I hadn't attended the Indian Business Conference, if I had not met Ms. Davuluri in person, if I had not connected with her, I would have written the same, the Miss America pageant is sexist. Isn't it a shame what racist pieces of shit we all are? Why are the internet jerks picking on this poor pretty girl? Bullshit, so many other columnists and bloggers did. So that's the end of the quote from his column. So why was the Ann Arbor Chronicle renowned for government and civic affairs coverage? Why did we send somebody to cover a visit from Miss America to Ann Arbor? Well, one thing is she was speaking to the Ross Business School students for the Indian Business Conference. But the other reason was I found out that she'd been chosen Miss America in kind of a weird way. I was cruising through.
Excuse me, before we get into her story, I want to continue talking about the alternative press.
Sure.
From different angles.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we'll hear about her story later.
Absolutely.
Each of your stories, my question is, I assume, based on my experiences with Fifth Estate, it was not clear sailing. You guys, each of you, you women, had an idea to create a publication, an alternative publication. You identified your own need to do it, which you've talked about, and we can imagine what the need was compared in terms in relationship to the mainstream media. I assume it wasn't clear sailing. How hard or how easy, maybe it was, in which case I want some of yours, was it to put out an alternative publication like the Chronicle and like Agenda and like the Ann Arbor Sun?
Well, there were many challenges, and the first really big challenge is technical. Back then, we didn't have computers, so you couldn't do your research by Googling and cell phoning and web interviewing people. You had to really get in your car, get on the phone, get to the library or whatever. So just doing the research and writing the articles was the first step. The second step was the part of putting the publication together. We have desktop publishing now, and it's a relative breeze how fast you can put a publication together. We had to typewrite or typeset, galleys of type, cut, so you'd have actual pieces of paper that you cut, you'd wax the back of them, you'd place
by
them
hand?
On. Oh, by everything's by hand.
You touched it?
You touched every item. You know, first you did a sketch and designed it and told your typesetter how narrow or wide you wanted the type and what size, and hopefully you did it right so it would fit on the page with the picture that you had in mind, and they wouldn't have to go back and retype the whole thing. Pictures had to be copied on a humongous photostat machine, made half tones with little dots so that it would reproduce okay. If you wanted a border on it, you didn't just put Command B, 1 to get a 1-point border. You took a little roll of plastic tape and you had to line it up and cut it perfectly and work on a light box or a drafting table.
A light box.
Corrections. Oh, my goodness. You know, proofreading and corrections was a whole other thing. You couldn't just use spell check. You read it. Uh-oh. So you would be cutting out with an X-Acto blade and a ruler these little words here and there and getting your sheet of corrections and sentences and cutting them and putting tape behind and hoping you got it straight enough and it didn't tear the whole sheet apart. So it was very time consuming. It was intense. You put in very long hours, if not a couple all-nighters before your deadline when you had to go to press.
It was also beautiful. I mean, it's not as if you phoned it in. The Ann Arbor Sun broke a lot of rules in terms of layout, as did the agenda. I can't speak to online publications in terms of the layout, but I know that...
We wrap type around photographs. We curve
different shaped photographs.
Yeah, we curve type. I mean, and headlines, that's a whole other thing. We had sheets of, it's called press type, and they were letters that, plastic letters that were attached to a sheet, and you'd put your B down on your paper, on your, and line it up, and you'd rub it with a wooden tool, and you'd go to your next letter, and you'd get your whole headline out together, and if it was too big, you'd have to start all over again with a smaller type
size.
Right. It was very hands-on, and it was very intense, and, you know, a lot, we do a lot of hand-drawing into it as well.
And if you looked at the mainstream press at the time, it was pretty ugly, aesthetically. I mean, I'm not even talking about content. That's another story. But aesthetically, the columns and the black and white, they didn't even use color until we taught them how to do that. But that's another story. How was it for you? What were your challenges?
I think the biggest thing overall was how we were going to sustain a publication. And right from the beginning, we knew this would be a problem. That was so political in nature, but wasn't organized as a nonprofit 501c3 that relied on grants and what have you to sustain itself. We wanted to be a publication that was embraced by all the sectors of Ann Arbor, including the business community. So the challenge was to sell advertising in a lot of ways, that we were mainly funded by advertising revenues, and it was never easy for the whole 12 years to do that. Advertisers only needed one or two complaints about something, and they considered it, you know, not to be worth the risk anymore. We distribute our newspaper at over 300 locations throughout the city and the surrounding towns. So we were very public about our presentation. We had covers that were sometimes offensive to some people. We were very in your face about our politics. So that was an ongoing thing, and I think that we were embraced by much of, or at least enough of, the Ann Arbor business community to do what we did for 12 years.
Wow.
The other part sort of took care of itself as far as content goes, because we were dealing with a town that was very politically active. There were probably 50 to 100 organizations that were dealing with political progressive issues or liberal human service organizations delivering services. And these were our target audience as well as content providers.
Thank you. Dave.
So what you described, Barbara, I'm happy to say I have no idea what you're talking about. But I would offer this.
Didn't think so.
So I would imagine that people who had a copy of that publication in their hand, they surely must have at some level recognized that what they had was the product of a large amount of human sweat and labor and tedious, awful work to bring that into existence, and that reflected itself a certain amount of wherewithal, financial resources, or at least the support of a large number of people, which I would imagine gave the publication some amount of credibility just because of the physical form of the delivery mechanism. So that the ease with which we were able to bring our words to the internet, I think, worked against us the same way it works against any online-only publication, which is, oh, well, it's the internet. Who can trust the internet? That's easy. There's a perception that if it's digital only, if it's online only, then it's maybe not trustworthy. How can you really trust that what's there is true, given that so much of online content is simply the fact-free opinions of people ranting on blogs?
So what were your struggles then, or what was the downside to putting out it?
Well, the downside is that, you know, when you're trying to sell advertising.
Oh, yes.
That
then.
Right. So the same problems that a printed publication would have, you have those. On top of that, you have, well, it's online only, so do we have any confidence that this is in any sense real? So that was, even though on the one hand it was easy to bring, or it was easy to publish, the act of publishing is trivial compared to what you described, that the credibility that comes along with that arduous process, we didn't have automatically. So that had to be earned over time.
Okay. What was Ann Arbor like as a market? Was it a particularly good place? Because I had very little contact with Ann Arbor when I was with the paper, other than seeing Phil Oakes at Hill Auditorium. That was amazing. So what kind of market was Ann Arbor to do what you were doing?
Mm-hmm. As far as businesses, advertising, or just in general?
Just the gestalt of publishing an alternative newspaper that got people excited. I mean, people were not excited by reading the news in Free Press and the Ann Arbor News. It didn't generate a lot of, but there was some, it was a movement. It was exciting. We were all part of a shared community on one level. So was Ann Arbor a good place to do it?
Ann Arbor was a great place to do it. There was so much going on, both politically and culturally. Great music going on. The Ann Arbor Blues and Jazz Festivals were certainly highlights during the period of time that I started working on the Ann Arbor Sun. And there were weekly concerts. And in fact, the White Panther Party, which evolved into the Rainbow People's Party, which evolved into just the community that worked on the Ann Arbor Sun, plus the people who had been in the Rainbow People's Party and White Panther Party, continued to change. We're part of trying to change, make major changes in Ann Arbor to reflect the progressive nature of what people wanted. So free medical clinic access, and food co-op, and trying to get Human Rights Party activists onto city council, and trying to change the marijuana laws. All those kinds of things entered into what we would cover in the newspaper, and I think what people were interested in and were excited about. But it still was always a struggle financially, because most of the advertisers indeed advertised in the major publications. And most of the college students were busy with their studies and didn't really want to pay for the publication or advertise. So there was always a little bit of both going on.
Did you have a golden era of advertising? I remember when we moved to Plum Street, the only reason the Fifth Estate survived for 50 years is we moved to Plum Street down in Detroit, which was a Haight-Ashbury-like community, and our offices were on the third floor. The second floor, we sold dirty and political bumper stickers and buttons. Save water, shower with a friend, draft beer, not students. Saved our ass, and really, we made quite a lot of money on that. And then the over-the-counter culture, as I called it, the over-the-counter counterculture, discovered us. I mean, that our readers, your readers, listened to radio and bought records. So suddenly Columbia Records and Liberty Records and Verve Music, they all bought ads. Did you have an opportunity to bask?
I think we had some of that. Some of that may have been before I started working on the paper. I started when the paper was trying to open itself up to the community and not be just a voice piece of the Rainbow People's Party. So we did have some advertising, and then I think perhaps if we had stayed in Ann Arbor, that would have really blossomed a great deal. But for a variety of reasons, many of them political, we decided to move the paper to Detroit. We felt that Coleman Young really had an uphill battle. People were white people were leaving the city, the economic base was leaving the city. He was trying to establish a whole different change in giving power to black and white people together and changing the police force to be 50% women, 50% African, so there would be representation reflecting the community. And we really liked what was going on, much of what was going on. We felt he was being very bashed by the traditional media. We also felt that the culture and the arts in Detroit was extraordinary, and it was not getting covered. And those were some of the reasons we decided to move the paper into the Detroit area.
A golden era in advertising? No, I'd say not.
You got lucky.
We did all right. And we did have to appeal to some reluctant business owners with lines like, you know, liberals wear shoes and buy shoes, or they eat food, or, you know, do you really want to cut these people out from your business because of your own politics, sort of thing.
How about the issue of Ann Arbor as a community?
As a community, thank you. It was very, very exciting time to be in Ann Arbor, I thought, and it was due to, I think a national movement that wasn't political but cultural, and a lot of it grew out of the punk ethos of, people can, if you want to, you like rock and roll, you want to be in a rock and roll band, well, go out and start your own sort of thing. And the subculture in Ann Arbor was exciting, the music, the politics, what have you. It wasn't the 60s, and with a national backdrop of conservatism, with the election of Ronald Reagan in 1990 and a turn to the right in general by the country, it made Ann Arbor even more of an exciting place. And the people who were dedicated to politics in this city were the most exciting, I think. They had an energy and a commitment that was great to be around.
Great. So Ann Arbor as a community and Ann Arbor as a market. So for the Ann Arbor Chronicle, there was no golden era of advertising as best I know. Mary Morgan can probably give you a more detailed answer. But we launched in 2008.
Okay. Yikes.
Yeah.
Sorry to hear about that.
Right. So
my condolences.
So, any extra discretionary money that anybody had, it had just disappeared. So it was a really rough time to be launching anything much less an online news and information okay. website. But against that, I would say Ann Arbor as a community, you know, the Teeter Talk website, in its second year, I was actually able to sell 6 ads. One of them, somebody, I think it was you in the introductory remarks, you referred to this as an amazing library. One of those advertisers was the Ann Arbor District Library.
Not surprised.
On a website that featured interviews on a teeter-totter. Now, that to me...
Only in Ann Arbor. I'm sorry. That, we don't do that in Detroit.
Yeah, well, that to me teeter. Was amazing. And so that reflects a certain wondrousness about this community and its willingness to support ventures like the Ann Arbor Chronicle. I am eternally grateful for the advertisers that took a shot with us, and as well as the voluntary subscribers. I think that in the end, our revenue was about 40%. People who just sent us money for no reason, because all of our content was freely available.
That's great.
One thing to keep in mind about Ann Arbor is it has a publication called the Ann Arbor Observer. And when it comes to advertising dollars, they're the main squeeze. And whatever was left over might get thrown to Current, might end up with Agenda or what have you. And the Observer is a terrific publication. I don't know of very many like it around the country. So I don't mean to take away from them, but it was on that front, it was a struggle because of them.
Okay. I have one more question as a group, and then I'd like to open it up to everyone to participate in this conversation. In the end, what kind of impact do you think the alternative press had in Ann Arbor? In other words, what difference did it make? Why did the Chronicle and the Sun and Agenda matter? Heavy, Mr. O, very heavy, as my fourth graders would say. Who cared in the end? I mean, what difference did it make?
I think having alternative voices is very important, and alternative voices that aren't pretending to be neutral and objective necessarily, just trying to get the truth out and being advocates for progressive change. And Ann Arbor was certainly ripe for progressive change, and I think we can see some of the fruits of the labor today, although we're still struggling with some of the same challenges, whether it be the marijuana laws, whether it be universal health care, whether it be economic equality, racial and social justice, we're still working at it. And I think it's really important that there be publications that communicate those issues, both the local fights and the global fights that we share. And I think that's probably one of the most important reasons why we need to continue to have alternative methods of communication. Now it's a lot easier because we've got the internet and doesn't have the same kind of printing bills attached to it or the intensity of the labor that I described.
Great.
I think the one of the main differences Agenda made was to provide a forum for the alternative political community in town. And by doing such, by having news and information month after month that was covering the events and their organizations and being written largely in part by members of these organizations, that we provided a sense of identity, a communal sense that we were all in this together. We were working on different issues. We were at different levels of involvement, but nonetheless, we all shared this great hope for a more progressive world. And on a practical level, I think we made a difference on some of the local issues. For example, say housing for affordable housing for people, for helping homeless people find services and what have you. It was a great political debate, and we covered it extensively. And there was an organization called Homeless Action Committee that was very effective at what they did. And so many of the things that we enjoy today that are progressive in our town grew out of a lot of the issues and work that we covered. And we were standing on the shoulders of the folks before us as well, the Sun and the political community of the 60s of Ann Arbor and the 70s. And so I think we made a great difference, even though we didn't change the world necessarily.
We did our part. We tried.
So I would say that, I mean, to the extent that we had an impact, that impact can continue to be felt through the magic of the Ann Arbor District Library's archiving efforts. So everything that we published still looks the same way it did. It's findable, it's searchable online. And the information that's there and the way we presented it, I know for a fact, continues to be informative for people who find something there they're looking for. So just yesterday, Mary Morgan received an email from someone, I'm not even sure where he's from, but he had found our report of the Planning Commission's meeting of June 17th, 2014. And here's just a little snippet of what he wrote. During the last 10 years, I've spent quite a bit of time reading articles, both technical from the broader media, as well as a fair amount of case law on the subject matter of religious communities and their interactions with municipalities in regards to housing. I believe it's accurate to say that your article is the best I've read during those years. Wow. In terms of gaining insight into the mindset of a governmental entity.
Wow.
When I finished reading your article, I said something to myself I've never previously said. Quote, I think I understand that which would be required to obtain permission for a house from my religious order in the municipality at which I'm looking. This statement was not just in reference to technical requirements, but primarily in terms of what the issues are in the minds of the local politicians and bureaucrats and how they think. So our record of that meeting captured the essence of the Planning Commission's attitudes towards this notion of functional family and what counts as a functional family. And for anybody who wants to find out what at that moment in time Ann Arbor was thinking about that issue, or at least what planning commissioners were thinking and what neighbors were thinking and what the religious order was thinking, it's there. And to me, I mean, a letter like this validates 6 years of work.
That's small, but it's huge. It really is huge. I mean, it's really amazing. Congratulations. You never know how it comes back to you. Peter Werby, who also worked on the paper and still does work on the paper at Fifth Estate, we got an email from France 4 or 5 months ago. They have an Andy Warhol museum, and they wanted permission to reprint my article covering the Andy Warhol Maud wedding. You had to be there. The Maud wedding at the state fair. I said, Peter, I don't remember writing it. He said, wait, you must have, because they want to use it in their museum.
And you said, yes, of course.
Of course. You don't know how it's going to come back to you. And in fact, the Detroit Historical Museum has an exhibit called Start the Presses, 50 Years of the Fifth Estate. And MOCAD, the Art Museum, Modern Museum of Contemporary Art, Detroit, has another exhibit called You Can't Print That, 50 Years of the Fifth Estate. And one of the things I learned, and I didn't really realize until we put these two exhibits together, commemorating the 50th anniversary of our paper, and one day they'll commemorate yours as well, is the impact we had on on journalism. Hello. We didn't know we were making history, but the Fifth Estate in 1967 was required reading by the editors of the News and Free Press to find out what young people and black people and women, I mean, you have to appreciate in 65 when the Fifth Estate was started, women's issues were quarantined to the society section. There really was a society section or a features section. And unless they were in trouble, black people and young people, you know, barely existed. And yet eventually the Detroit News started their own underground section. So in terms of content, I think we whether we know it or not, I think we have an impact not only on our readers, but others. Peter didn't give a shh. Sorry, we're taping. He didn't care that much about its impact on the mainstream press. I did, because I became mainstream very quickly after I left the paper, after I went into radio and television and filmmaking and screenwriting and teaching and everything else. But also in terms of your work of layout and design. Grimshaw, Gary Grimshaw was our art director before he did the work at the Grandy Ballroom on those posters. Pretty cool. Anyway, let's open it up. We have 35 more minutes to talk, and we have a microphone. So raise your hand, and Amy will find you.
Hi. This is quite wonderful. I enjoyed. I was in Detroit in those early days, and I'm sorry to say I didn't always connect as much as I might have. But I remember the Fifth Estate when it first came out and the excitement about that.
Cheers.
But I'm looking at us and thinking about us here, how white we all still are, and I wonder if you could address voices from the black community and other communities that.
Well, certainly when we moved the Sun to Detroit, we integrated our staff to reflect the population that we were reaching. So Nadine Brown, who was a columnist for the Michigan Chronicle, was one of our regular columnists. Ken Cockrell mentored us and worked on the paper. And we had a very diverse staff and tried to reflect that. If you look at some of the old copies, and this is from the very beginning, the art section was amazingly in depth about jazz and black arts and blues, and you really couldn't find that kind of coverage anyplace else.
You couldn't even find it in some issues of the Fifth Estate. The reason there's an Ann Arbor Sun is Sinclair was so pissed at me in 1966 that the Fifth Estate was so political, and there wasn't enough music, and there wasn't enough dope, and there wasn't enough jazz, and there wasn't enough art, that I heard this from Barry Kramer, and he left because I wouldn't print his music review to start Cream Magazine. Sinclair started the Warren Forest Sun, which became the Ann Arbor Sun. So thank you. No, you're welcome. So you're welcome. In terms of, I think social injustice and civil rights was always, I think, I know the Sun and certainly the Fifth Estate was core to our motivation for starting the paper and circulating the paper. We printed articles that nobody else did. Our riot coverage put the Free Press to shame. We found out before anybody else did that the people who were being killed were not National Guards people or civilians, but they were civilians being killed by National Guardsmen. So I think you do the best we can. Our shooter was Wilson Lindsay, our photographer, who was an African-American, after Lenny Sinclair went to work for The Sun. I think social injustice and civil rights has always been prominent. That's one of the things, sadly, that's what made us an alternative press. How screwed up is that? That made you an alternative. I can't speak for the agenda, or for agenda, or the Chronicle.
Well, we're holding a mirror up to Ann Arbor, certain parts of it anyway, and whatever it is that was reflected was there, and there were groups on campus who participated with Agenda and who advocated for civil rights and social justice, certainly for people of color and people who were economically challenged. But I think the main thing that was going on as far as race issues, it was dominated by what was the apartheid situation in South Africa. And there was one group in town, the Free South Africa Coordinating Committee, that was very, very active on the issue. And one of their leaders, Barbara Ransby, wrote quite a few columns for Agenda over the years. And she covered many different facets of the issue.
I think you have to judge the impact of the alternative press. I'm trying not to say underground press, to date myself more than I have to. by its impact on African Americans and others. For example, in Detroit, because of the Fifth Estate, John Watson, among others, took over the Daily Collegian, the newspaper at Wayne State University, and made it into the South End. Okay. And he's an African-American man who did that, not to mention the creation of the Inner City Voice. The Voices were African-Americans and others created their own alternative. And not only African-Americans, high school students created underground papers, anti-war Vietnam veterans, not even veterans, they were GIs, created their own underground alternative media. So I forgot about that.
You remember the Winter Soldiers?
I covered it for ABX. Are you kidding?
Publication called FPS?
No.
In Ann Arbor.
Well, see, I was from...
FPS, anybody remember them?
No.
Tell it. I wrote them.
Tell it. Tell it, sister. What the hell?
Actually, that was going to be my comment. It was about the effect on young people. 40 years after the fact, I'm going to start with thanking the Sun for covering a story from community high school, which was censored. We elected the first gay homecoming queen probably in all of the country, I'm guessing.
I photographed that person, I remember.
Yeah, and so
we had
the Ann Arbor News ready to go and do a photo, a story about it, and our dean called him and said, oh, please don't. And they didn't, but the Sun did. And I have shared that story repeatedly over the last 40 years.
Thank you.
Who are you? What's your name?
Linda Diane Felt.
They don't call it the underground. Excuse me. Shoot.
So we had
alternative press for nothing.
That came from our alternative newspaper. That whole story, that called the Yenta, which our motto was chicken soup for the mind, and we had to go underground essentially. When I wrote an article about birth control information, which at that point was not allowed to be taught in schools, and so I wrote up an entire article about what to do, where to do it, how, and how effective. And they said, we're going to suspend you if you publish that. And we got the school board to agree that we had First Amendment rights, and we published it. FPS rewrote it, republished it. And
what
did
FPS stand for?
Fuck public schools.
Thank you. Sorry, Amy.
Since you asked.
They would say, depending on the company they were with, they would say free public schools.
I understand.
So that was it. And then Keith Hafner, who was the originator of that, went to New York and started empowering other students and young people to do their own press. And just the final thing I would say is that the other alternative paper that was in town was also called The Alchemist, and was not quite as political, but certainly an alternative press that was there for the late 70s, early 80s, I think.
Little victories. Thank you. You mentioned the Winter Soldier investigation. One of the reasons I left the Fifth Estate was to become the news director at ABX. I had a great time. And we covered the hours and hours of the Winter Soldier investigation when the mainstream press, that was when the Vietnam veterans came back. I have to remember that Amy's saying, well, these Vietnam veterans came back from Vietnam in an era when we were sending all these troops there, but they were coming back and they were showing the ears that they cut off from Viet Cong prisoners, and they talked about and had photographs of all the atrocities that as American soldiers they participated in Vietnam. It was called the Winter Soldier Investigation.
So if I could just interject a comment. You ask who she was. She's mostly famous, I think, as an alum of the Teeter Totter. And a quick question for the gentleman who raised the question by asking, you know, we still seem awfully white here. And I just wanted to clarify what you meant by that. Do you mean literally here in the room that it's mostly just us white folks?
Both, actually.
Yeah. So I'm grateful for your having posed the question, because there's a former member of the city council from the 1970s era whose acquaintance I met this summer, who, when I told her about this panel, her remark was, well, okay, so it's a panel for the white privileged alternative press. Where's the black alternative press on that panel? And I didn't have a good answer for her. But she said, you should raise that question, Dave, you should find an opportunity to raise that question. So I thank you for raising the issue.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, I want to thank everyone. This was a most enlightening panel. I learned a lot. First of all, I just have to say, I did not make the connection. Map of the World. I have all your albums and singles and CDs, and I would have brought them here had I known. And that's, huh? Yes, yes. And the song, I don't know if it's the title, but the lyric, Stop Thinking Now.
Yes.
It's my favorite. I mean, I love it.
Only in Ann Arbor. That's all I have to say.
What's that?
We closed a lot of shows with that.
Okay, yeah. I go way back, and I haven't forgotten. I love it.
It's great to hear that.
But I did have one question, especially addressed to Harvey, but to everyone, I guess. All except the Fifth Estate are no longer in production.
Yes.
You're right. And it's being curated like a historic item now, you know? And also you mentioned the business about, which I agree with, you know, on the internet in general, it's very dispersed and dissolute and you know, not limited to the facts or whatever, you know, and all of that. And so, you know, today, do you collectively think, and especially Harvey, since you're still in publication or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, do you collectively think that the torch is still being passed for the mission that you had mentioned, you know, is so important, you know, that there be an alternative voice, as it were, is the torch being passed? Not that I can see by actual printed newspapers anymore very much, okay, you know, but is it somehow, or is it, you know, now in a phase of curation and history?
No, it's strong. It is ancient. As much as I recall fondly my adventures with the Fifth Estate, and so much in my life changed as a result of it, it is ancient history to me. It was 50 years ago, okay? But I do want to say that it's alive and well. I listen to NPR. I'm telling you. I listen to National Public Radio. I listen to Michigan Radio here in Ann Arbor, and I feel like I'm back. Right. All over again. Right. The sense of shared community and values mm-hmm. is powerful, and it's just not limited anymore to the press, the print media, but now on the web, but on radio.
And certainly still in print. The Metro Times has some great moments. Kurt Guyette really hit it on his coverage of the emergency manager and many other incredible. And Jack Lessenberry does the time, and Larry Gabriel has some really wonderful moments.
And Dan Savage. We had Dr. Hippocrates, who gave a sidebar. I'm sorry, I have to do this. Dr. Hippocrates. We were interviewed on Michigan Radio here in Ann Arbor by Cindy Canty on her show at 3 o'clock called Stateside. And she revealed that much of what she learned in her Catholic high school upbringing about sex education came less from the nuns and more from Dr. Hippocrates, a.k.a. Dan Savage today. I'm back. You go ahead.
No, that
sidebar.
That's certainly it. So,
I'm sorry I interrupted you.
That's okay.
But I think it's still Hippocrates, Savage, NPR, Metro Times.
CBC Radio,
yes. Of course.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And Lord knows what else is out there on the web. I don't feel deprived of the feelings that I had when I used to read and publish alternative papers. I feel like it's out there. You just have to find it. And support it, by the way. Support it.
Speaking of that, I run an online news site in Oakland County called Oakland County 115. We've been around for 5 years, and we're having a lot of success with it. What advice do you have for people that are fairly new at this and going into
question.
It?
Are you saying you came here from Oakland County tonight?
Yes.
In this weather?
Yeah, it was terrible.
I know.
In an hour.
Wow.
I found out about it an hour before.
Well, that's just a terrific question and worth the trip.
Is it print?
It's an online news site, and it's OC115. I don't know if he's looking it up. It's OC115.com. It's all online. We started in one city, which was Ferndale, and about a year ago expanded to a countywide framework that we're growing into right now. Oakland County. And we used to publish on the 1st and 15th of every month as an online
newspaper. And what's your point as a publication? What are you there for? Why do you exist?
Community news, local news.
In Oakland County?
In Oakland County, okay. But it's city by city. So okay. The motto is to inform, inspire, and unite. And we cover everything from city council meetings, school boards, entertainment, yeah. That kind of stuff. We've had a couple of big successes with investigative reporting as well.
Stories, telling stories. I think we have gotten used to, and there's a tremendous need in the media to tell and for us to listen to stories. Wake me when the data is over. You know, I think what you can do is to look for opportunities to, I teach screenwriting, so some of this is like very familiar to me, but to identify characters, you know, to write about, not just institutions and organizations, but characters that people can care about and identify and root for, that makes the stories stick. Telling stories, identifying that not only that stories have a plot. Like one of the problems with a lot of writers, journalists, and documentary producers and others is they tell you they only scratch the surface. Their plot is who's in this story and what do they want and what's the problem and how are they going to achieve it. That's plot. A theme. Theme is the secret sauce. Theme is the secret sauce. Not what your story is about, which is superficial and above the surface. There are no surprises above the surface, but what the story is really about. And I think if more journalists would understand that their stories consist, if you want stories to congeal or stick or coagulate, they have to not just be about something, but what's the theme, what's the message, what's the moral, what's the point of this story? Why are we really telling this story? If you can do that, you're gonna find people consciously and unconsciously in a very cathartic, I'll get off my soapbox in a second, in a very cathartic way, identify and relate to your stories. And email me, harveyo@hkomedia.com. Anybody who can drive in this weather to Ann Arbor, harveyo@hkomedia.com, and remind me who you are.
Could I just add a counterpoint to that?
Sure.
So I think that, I mean, everything you said, obviously I agree with in terms of what makes good storytelling. I think that my advice to you for this publication is to figure out, do you want to be storytellers? And if you do, then listen to every word that Harvey said. I think there's a place in modern journalism for articles that eschew the storytelling approach, that take the traditional narrative storytelling and say, okay, we don't need that. I mean, that's certainly the approach that the Ann Arbor Chronicle took. We didn't try to tell stories. We said,
how did you personalize your stories? Because that's what storytelling does. It personalizes. It makes a connection. It individualizes. When you covered the hearings or the events, did you focus on them en masse, or did you focus on individuals? I don't know. I'd like to learn this.
Well, I guess, I mean, I was never trying to tell a story. I was trying to document proceedings. I was trying to illuminate what happened there so that there was an accurate record of everything that happened.
I see.
And, you know, if somebody said something that I didn't understand at the time or I didn't understand the allusion, then I would go back.
So you didn't frame it at all in any context?
So I wasn't trying to tell a story. So my point is not that what you've described as good storytelling isn't accurate. I think that you've done a really great job of describing what good storytelling is. And if your aim is to tell a story.
Well, my aim is to connect. I don't know how to connect with facts. This is my problem, and I don't know how to connect with facts and data and information without being able to identify. You know, as a writer, part of the problem is I am a writer, and we teach in writing how to write. You don't write about the hand. We write about the gesture. You don't write about the mouth, you write about the smile. There's a way to contextualize and personalize data and information and coverage in such a way that makes other people give a darn about the event that you're covering as much as you care about it that led you to want to cover it in the first place.
Well, I mean, I don't disagree that there's a place for that. I'm arguing that there is a place for the kind of journalism that says, if you want to be a writer, go do something else. The task here is not a writerly task so much as the task of a documentarian.
I am a documentarian. So, are you also not talking about reporting? This is stunning.
It's a different philosophy of whether you just kind of give the facts or whether you tell compelling stories that have the facts within those stories and compels your reader to have an emotional attachment and remember those stories and feel transformed by them.
And want to do something about it. And that comes, I guess I call that reporting. But I'm going to have to look. I'm glad there's a library that's documenting the Chronicle, because I need to go back and see what you did, because I'm just not familiar.
Just to
with
give
that.
You an example, my current job, the way I pay the bills, is I work for a company called Prime Research, and it's basically a fancy. Well, we're recording this. I need to put this in a positive way. We prepare newsletters for major multinational companies, summarizing the news. So one of the tasks associated with any article is to find a couple of sentences in the article that actually is relevant to our client. So a lot of reporting, especially say in the field of education, you have to go through a paragraph that's trying to tell me a story, trying to connect with me. You know, Jose walked down the long hallway, blah, 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 blah. It's like, what? Okay, the real point of this story? Arne Duncan resigned. So, to me...
But what does that mean to individuals? Who cares if he resigned? What does that mean to the community, to individuals in the community specifically? How do you personalize that?
I don't know. This is a little off track to exactly apologize. What you're speaking about. But we practice what we call advocacy journalism.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the mere telling, the placement of the article, the graphics that go with it,
the headline.
All the decisions that go into presenting the story.
Most importantly is, if you're going to be alternative, you've got to present information that isn't available elsewhere. And I think that's what makes any of these publications essential.
Or you present it in a more in-depth way that gives you
correct,
a different,
yes.
You may read the same story in the traditional media, but you aren't getting the same information necessarily or same twist of the impact of why you're even covering it.
We also try to remove the editors from the story. We practice what we call verbatim journalism often, and that meant recording a lecture, a speech, and presenting it in its entirety without comment. We would go to demonstrations and simply carry a microphone and ask people, why are you here? And their response was printed verbatim. Mm-hmm. So there's many different ways to connect with people without necessarily interjecting.
And I appreciate hearing that. And I think what I'm hearing us, what you say, and I apologize for jumping on you like that, and I hear what you're saying as well, is that even within the universe of alternative media, there's alternatives to alternative media. And I'm sorry, I'm just used to, I've been doing this a long time, one way, more than 50 years. And I want to go back and read the Chronicle and try to understand what you're talking about.
Well, I mean, one contrast would be, for example, election morning coverage for city council or mayoral races. So we didn't go to the candidates' celebration parties. Mainstream media, that's where they're at. we basically facilitated the early election reporting results through a shared Google spreadsheet so that essentially the results that the candidates were looking at and that the mainstream press was reporting on, they were declaring victory based on the information that we were publishing on our website and the shared Google spreadsheet. So we were reporting essentially pure data. We weren't trying to tell a story. We were reporting the data that then somebody else was going and telling a story about. And my attitude was, go and tell your stupid story. I don't care about your stupid story. Because when we publish our article the following morning, it's not going to be quotes from the winning candidates, how disappointed the losing candidates are disappointed. No kidding. The winning candidates are happy. Yes, indeed. You know, a color-coded map, precinct by precinct, showing the relative strength of each candidate in each of 48 precincts, you know, with shading to say, here's how that unfolded. Now, you can call that a story. You could write it up as a story. But, I mean, to me, that's more about, here's facts that I trust my readers to be able to look at the map and to understand. And when I tell them each candidate was strongest in their home territory, but this candidate was clearly had, you know, was stronger citywide, that they can look at the map and say, oh, okay, so this must be where Stephen Kunzelman lives, and this must be where Saber Briere lives, and this must be where Sally Peterson lives. So, you know, I would encourage you to consider that there's also a place for reporting that does not even try to tell a story, that consciously says, I'm not going to tell you a story. I'm just going to present you with raw information, that there's a place for that.
I didn't know that. I'm glad I know that. Yes, sir.
Mary should weigh in on this, but we don't have a daily paper anymore. We don't have hardly any reporters for the online paper, sure. MLive. So what Dave and Mary were doing was probably done much better 10 or 20 years ago at the Ann Arbor News, when they used to have reporters covering local government meetings, but the MLive just doesn't do that much anymore. So that's why I think we needed something like that.
Is Mary here?
Yeah, she's sitting in the back.
Where? Mary, Lori, Mary. If there aren't any questions, I think we'll ask Amy to wrap it up.
Okay.
Although I would encourage, self-servingly, so for the sake of the library, if you had a good experience, go on social media and Facebook and elsewhere and tell everyone where you were tonight and how you felt about the experience. Let's see more public meetings like this at the library. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I just wanted to have the opportunity to say that Agenda involved hundreds of people over more than a decade. And all the work that went into it from the community was essentially what defined the paper and made it successful. And it's really important to remember that it was a tremendously rich experience to be involved with the people in town who were so well informed, well read, and cared so much about the issues that they thought needed work on. And so I just wanted to make sure that it was understood that Agenda was a real community newspaper. Mm-hmm. Supported by many, many different parts of the community.
Any other final 1-minute remarks?
I think it's a real credit to the Agenda that you can talk about hundreds of people who worked on the paper.
Thank you.
That's incredible. Because mm-hmm. I can only talk about 2 plus some columnists.
Well, I think I can talk about hundreds also that our paper reached and reported on and people that were involved in one way or the other. And so many of the people that were inspired and learned at the Ann Arbor and Detroit Sun and had the opportunity to work with John Sinclair and Lenny Sinclair and with all the folks that were there every day from the beginning have gone on in many, many interesting ways to become journalists and supporters of peace and justice and social action organizations and music producers and some really very, very moving and important positions. So it was a great learning experience, and I'm very grateful for the Ann Arbor Library for having all those issues online so you can see what the period of time was like and what the content was like.
For caring enough to even do it. And then conduct the panel like this in this weather.
Well, we'd like to thank you all for participating. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And please visit Old News at the Ann Arbor District Library.
Thank you.
Thank you.